My ambition after that trip to the Highlands was simply to see if Tasmania could make a really good single malt whisky.
We don't expect everyone to like these wines, so yes, there's some risk.
Drink more sherry, because that's when you can really educate yourself on what happens in maturation.
The thing is with Australian natives, you put them in a gin, the aftertaste invariably is just bitter and unpalatable.
I think the Irish whisky landscape is going to be wildly different over the next 5 years.
This is the Drinks Adventures podcast. I'm James Atkinson, and this is the show where I speak to some of the world's most exciting producers of beer, wine and spirits, and uncover trends and issues in the drinks industry today.
The small Scottish coastal town of Campbelltown was once home to over 30 distilleries, and it was known as the Victorian whisky capital of the world. Today, Glen Scotia is one of three surviving distilleries in the region. And both Glen Scotia and Campbelltown are developing a strong reputation among whisky enthusiasts. In spite of the region's production output, which is tiny in the context of Scotch whisky, Glen Scotia is now owned by the Loch Lomond Group, and a continuing program of investment has brought dividends for the distillery. In 2021, Glen Scotia 25-year-old was awarded Best in Show at the San Francisco World Spirits Competition. Later that same year, Glen Scotia was named Scottish Whisky Distillery of the Year at the Scottish Whisky Awards, making it the first distillery ever to receive both accolades, let alone in the same year. Ian McAllister is at the forefront of driving this recognition. The former engineer has been at the helm of Glen Scotia for 15 years. Born and bred in Campbelltown, he is fiercely proud of the place he calls home, especially its community and its rich whisky heritage. Drawing on his background as an engineer, Ian has developed an enhanced production at Glen Scotia, whilst making sure to preserve the craftsmanship and traditional skills it values. I really enjoyed this conversation with Ian, made possible by the support of the Loch Lomond Group. We recorded this interview during Ian's first ever visit to Sydney in February 2023. Ian McAllister, thanks so much for joining us on the Drinks Adventures podcast.
Brilliant. Thank you. Thank you, James. Absolutely brilliant to be here.
Now, the first question to ask you is, you've been at Glen Scotia for 15 years, but I've just been reading that this is your first ever trip to come and see us in Australia. So why has it taken so long?
Yeah, good question. I mean, absolutely appalling behaviour on my part. Yeah, I mean, it's obviously now we're at the stage where Glen Scotia, I think, you know, it's, you know, the business is doing that well. It's great to obviously go and thank everybody, meet everybody, and just, you know, just get involved a bit more. So, fantastic.
Has there been, you know, quite an active program of putting more whisky down over the years that you can now kind of share increasingly with markets further afield?
Yeah, I mean, when you look at Glen Scotia, James, obviously back in 2008, you know, when I started in 2008, there was three of us there, were producing 80,000 litres. There was no concerted Glen Scotias available, really, per se. There was a 12-year-old, which was rather random. It's obviously fast forward to where we are now, and obviously we're sitting about 800,000. There's 13 of us in the distillery. So it's been a remarkable journey.
Only one Glen Scotia product was on the market, which was the 12-year-old. Is that what you were saying?
12, yeah.
And presumably a lot of the output was going into blends.
You know, really, when you look at the production from that period of time, James, there was really most of it was getting laid down. There was a small percentage that would be going to independent bottlers, because hence why there's quite a lot of independent bottles available from Glen Scotia at that time period. A little bit of the 12-year-old. There was some distillery single casks, but again, there were few and far between. You know, it's remarkable. I always remember having this discussion with my boss at the time, a guy called Mr. John Peterson, and he said, you know, I was obviously asking about the strategy, selling, how Glen Scotia gets sold at the time. And his words to me were, in a good year, we maybe bottle a cask of Glen Scotia. One cask.
Yep. Well, not real ambitious.
No, it's just the way it was at the time. You know, obviously there was, the distillery was working. It was part of the region question, you know, keeping the region alive. But there was no business model for the distillery at that time. So that's why it was in the position it was in. So it lost its confidence, for sure. You get a certain amount of interest in the distillery through diehard whiskey fans, but that was it.
And so did your arrival kind of coincide with, you know, a recent ownership change or something along those lines?
Yeah, I, well, 2008, so I was 2008, so really the first 5 years I was really just working on the processes at the distillery. So between myself and the two other guys that was there, that's all we were doing.
Fine-tuning things?
Fine-tuning, overhauling and really replacing if necessary. So it was quite
a bit more than fine-tuning.
It was quite a lot to do. There was in the early days. And luckily enough, that kind of coincided or concluded when the Loch Lomond Group took over. So they took over and were in a good position at that point. Everything was where it had to be with spirit quality, the production-wise and the distillery. So absolutely, you know, when the Loch Lomond Group took over, there was still a lot to do, but we're in a far better place than we were 5 years earlier. So it worked quite well, coincided really at a good juxtaposition, I think.
I did hear you say on another podcast I was listening, just sort of while I was doing my research for today, that the spirit had been pretty inconsistent in the years prior to when you arrived. But look, there must have still been some pretty good stuff getting put down when you look at some of the recent accolades, like the, you know, in 2021, I think it was the 25-year-old Glen Scotia that picked up Best in Show in San Francisco.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was a kind of pivotal point in the history of Glen Scotia, it really was. But yeah, I mean, the spirit quality was certainly variable. That wasn't the distillery's fault. It was basically just the way it was being run. You know, whoever was running it at that time, whatever company had its hold on it, then that was where all that came from. Don't get me wrong, you know, some it's incredibly good, some it's incredibly variable. That's it, you know, that's the facts. So, but yeah, when you find something that the 25-year-old obviously achieved, then it's remarkable for the place when you think where it was.
Obviously, Glen Scotia is one of three distilleries today in the Campbelltown region. I think because we're in Sydney, we should just clarify that we mean Campbelltown in Scotland, not Campbelltown 40 kilometres southwest of where we're currently sitting in Sydney. And the reason I say that is, I don't know if you heard recently, there was one of these cask investment companies that put a cask online that was allegedly from Campbelltown, and the picture that they had was a Google Maps picture of Campbelltown in Sydney. Yeah, so that kind of went viral on Twitter, and right. Blair Bowman, who you might know, was really dining out on that one. So Campbelltown in Scotland, where is that in Scotland? And, you know, what are the region's characteristics in terms of climate and geography for the uninitiated amongst my listeners?
Yeah, well, absolutely. You know, Campbelltown, west coast of Scotland, James, so it's obviously a small town. Nowadays, you would consider it quite difficult to get to. But Campbelltown really grew out of its geography. You know, it's situated in the west coast of Scotland, it's situated in the peninsula of Kintyre, and it was strategically positioned for trade with the Americas, with Europe, with Glasgow, with Liverpool, wherever. You know, there was obviously that through traffic. And that really, you know, the early days, that built Campbelltown. So the herring fisheries, and as I say, that maritime trade and that geographical position. So that obviously gave it that impetus to develop. And it did develop. It developed many different facets. One of its greatest exports was actually talent. You know, so a lot of really switched on individuals, business entrepreneurs, if you like, of the mid to late Victorian era came from Campbelltown, which is quite remarkable. So it had that talent, and it seemed to be the perfect storm for the whisky industry. So when the whisky industry developed through excise, taxation, to get everything just what it should be, obviously there was distilleries before that were legal and illegal, you know, back the latter half of the 18th century. But when you get to that early start of the 1830s, etc., in Campbelltown, then it was really, even before that, you know, 1817 was the first of the modern distilleries in Campbelltown. Campbelltown itself, the distillery is called. But when you get to that point, then everything really came together for Campbelltown. As I say, that through fare with the ships, the shipping, casks, wood, It would be woods initially, you know, staves, then it would be full barrels, barley, even draft. So they could move stuff quite easily. So Campbelltown was absolutely, you know, that was the place to be. And it developed, you know, it developed into a powerhouse. It was a region, but it was a town. Whereas you think a whiskey region has been many miles. You know, there's distilleries in Speyside, many miles. Even Islay, you know, it's not many miles in Islay, but they're still spread out. Campbelltown had that uniqueness where everything was cheek by jowl, side by side. Nowhere quite like it. And it's still, even to this day, Glen Scotia, Springbank, even Glengyle, you know, it's got that old world day, if you're stepping back in time, feel to it. That's really quite remarkable, you know, for a town, for a whisky region to have these facets. And the whisky itself is obviously unique. You know, it's that robust, oily, dirty even. You know, it's got these attributes, hopefully with a wonderful flavour profile. It really, really helps bring it alive.
And how much of that character is about, you know, the geography and the climate, or if, to use that wine term, terroir? It's always a, you know, highly debatable topic, isn't it, the role that terroir plays in whisky?
Campbelltown benefits from what they call the Gulf Stream. When you consider the latitude of Campbelltown, it was in the same latitude as Moscow and Newfoundland, places like that. So they're obviously incredibly cold places. But when you look at where obviously the west coast of Scotland and Campbelltown is, then it benefits from the Gulf Stream. The Gulf Stream is obviously a warm water current. It basically emanates from the Caribbean. So there's a certain amount of, obviously, it's slightly milder, warmer, damp. Summers, winters, they've pretty much morphed into one nowadays. And you get, obviously, you get what the term palm trees, you know, cordon lines, which I think are native to Australia, this part of the world. So they obviously grow quite happily in that latitude.
Right.
So it's quite amazing. And if you see, look at a picture, you study a picture of Campbelltown of the Esplanade, then you'll see these palm trees. It's quite remarkable. Yeah, it's obviously, it does help. It does help. You know, it obviously helps. That climate helps because it's not too warm, but it's not too cold. But in fact, it's not really warm at all, but it's certainly not cold.
Especially not to us.
No, exactly. Exactly. So, yeah, it's got a huge influence in the, you know, making a whiskey. You know, it's something that works.
So in the maturation we're talking about here, with the, you know, the interaction with wood and spirit, and then also with the maritime sort of air as well that's kind of circulating through the warehouses.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that rather as get too cold, and maturation, you know, tends to decrease obviously in the winter, you know, so the summer is slightly more reactive in the warehouses. Potentially it could be modern buildings or it could be old stone dunnages, and the difference can be quite marked between obviously, you know, the cold period and the warm period. The warm period's obviously not going to last that long in Campbelltown. But yeah, I mean, everything like that helps, you know, it really does. And it gives it, it is what it is. You can't change it, but it does give it that regionality. So that's all part of the deal with what is a Campbelltown whisky. Well, the weather we can't change. The weather tends to remain the same, you know, year in, year out. There's cycles, isn't there? You know, everything slightly changes time to time. But overall, you know, when you look at the picture overall, then there's that certain amount of continuity, which you could say, well, that is Campbelltown.
But the robust, oily sort of character that you talk about, that must also be to do with your distillation practices as well.
Yes, absolutely.
And equipment, I would assume, which maybe, is there any sort of anything unique that you want to tell us about there at Glen Scotia?
Well, absolutely, James. You know, when you look at the process at Glen Scotia, then the first thing you notice is the mash tun, the type of mash tun. We've got a rack and pinion type mash tun, and the mash tun is incredibly old, late Victorian, early Edwardian mash tun. So it's unforgiven, I think, is the best way of describing that type of mash tun. So it's all down to the operator. You know, they do an incredible job. They work with it really well. But it's something that takes a bit of talent, a bit of time, just to perfect. It's what you would expect from that era. It's mechanical, it's hands-on, it's obviously sometimes wrestling with it to get the results you want. But if you do get the results, wonderful, cloudy wort, you know, and that's what we're after. That's Glen Scotia. That gives us that whole regionality, right through to the stills. Obviously, fermentation wise, when I started, we looked at longer fermentation periods, which really helped develop the flavour profile. And again, through distillation, then we're obviously getting to a point where we can obviously isolate different aspects of that flavour. The small squat wash still, obviously, it's going to be slightly heavier, oily aspect. Same with the spirit still, it's not huge, but there's enough elegance, enough shape there to obviously just give enough balance, you know, while you've got the heavy, robust aspect. Time you get to that spirit still, then we're getting a lovely interaction with the flavour profile that we've obviously developed in fermentation.
As I sort of mentioned, I was in a masterclass that you presented a year or two ago, and I think you were telling us, as I recall, that, yeah, first fill bourbon casks were sort of, you know, the house style was kind of based around that maturation policy.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Again, you know, when I'm back to the early days, you know, there's quite a lot of variance in the casks. You know, some of them are quite old, some of them are refills, so a lot of first fills, some refill American oak, refill Scottish Hoggies, you know, hogshead casks. So a lot of that changed to first fill bourbon. We moved on and we laid down quite a bit of stock. Then it's first fill, the second fill, there's different charring levels. And yeah, even if you like, you know, exotic casks, but obviously a huge association with Campbelltown, you know, sherry casks, port casks, you know, so just looking at different aspects and trying to understand, even at this point, what works and what is that style, you know, what is Campbelltown, what is that, you know, what makes a good Glen Scotia Campbelltown whisky. So, yeah, it's incredibly interesting and hopefully it'll work.
Now, the whiskies that I know that we have in this market and that are probably some of the most important ones in your range are the double cask, the 15-year-old and the Victoriana. Tell us about how you developed these particular products and the unique characteristics and nuances that each of them have.
When you consider the double cask, you know, you're really looking for something where you can obviously... You've got a certain amount of stock, you've got a stock profile. So it's if obviously we've improved it, you know, we can start releasing it at a younger age. It's acceptable. It's got everything that we need, you know, the certain qualities that obviously reflects the distillery. Then something like a double cask is absolutely spot on. You know, it really is. Obviously, you get first fill bourbon, could be as young as potentially 5 years, 6 years. Then you've got a 9-month finish and first fill sherry PX butts. So, again, you know, obviously we're getting that association with the bourbon cask in Glen Scotia, yet historically you've got these sherry casks. So there's an element, obviously, a wonderful fruit flavour-driven bourbon aspect with the slightly spicier, heavier notes from the creme caramel, etc., from the, you know, raisin sultanas from that sherry cask. So it works really, really well. Incredibly popular, even in Campbelltown. That is one of the whiskies that's obviously really been a benchmark for the distillery. When you move on to the 15-year-old, yeah, absolutely. You know, it's probably got more characteristics than any of the other whiskies. But obviously, again, stock profile-wise, you've got to use what you've got. So obviously, it's quite complex, a 15-year-old. You know, you've obviously got refill bourbon, some refill oak, and you obviously vatten them together. Then it's into a first-fill bourbon. Then it's into for a short finish Oloroso. So you just a matter of weeks. So again, you've got that association, you know, the wonderful refill-driven flavour profile, slightly enhanced a little bit with the first-fill bourbon, and then developed that regionality. You've got that sherry, you know, it's slight sweetness coming through there. But yeah, it's really robust. It's got salinity. It's got an oiliness in the 15-year-old. So again, a wonderful whiskey in it. It was between the three you mentioned there, the new kids on the block. And when you get onto the Victoriana, well, my goodness, you know, what else could you call it? Victoriana, you know, Campbelltown was Victoriana. That was the Victorian whiskey capital of the world. So, I mean, that's really, you know, again, you've got a mix of refill, first fill bourbon. You're going to vat them together, 30% into sherry PX, but 70% in a real heavy, heavy charred American oak, quite a distinguished burn there. You're going to leave them for up to 12 months, then you're going to take the two liquids and marry them together for a final 6 months. And potentially that marrying period could be in refill bourbon, then you're going to bottle it, slightly higher strength, 54.2%. So, is it a Victorian whiskey? Well, it's as close as damn it, as they say.
I dare say it's probably a better drink than they would have been making back then as well. You know, with all the know-how and the effort that you're putting into it, surely the quality's improved.
Well, you would like to think so, wouldn't you? You know, and I was quite convinced, absolutely. And it's a wonderful whiskey. I love Victoriana. It won Scottish Whiskey, the Online Spirits Award, the Scottish Whiskey of the Year last year. It's out there. So that was incredibly special, you know. So it's obviously voted by the people that does the walk and the talking. So that was a big, big moment. But I think it's worth mentioning, you know, you can't take away from what they were producing in that era, because we think, obviously, we know it all now. Maybe not so much, because I had, and I still have, some new make spirits from the 1920s from a Campbelltown distillery. And I had enough to get a little bit of analysis done on it through the Scottish Whisky Research Institute. And the overarching result that came back from that was it's remarkably similar to what we do today. So when you consider that and you consider written evidence, you know, notes of how they were doing things from that period, they probably weren't that far away from what we're doing. Probably the only thing, you know, that production-wise is similar, you know, fermentation maybe not quite as long, but it's very, very similar. It's just when you get to the cask aspect, the maturation, it's maybe slightly fell down a wee bit, but they were good. They were good.
You just touched on the, you know, incredible heritage of Campbelltown in whiskey and, you know, the Victorian whiskey capital of the world. Yet, I think even now it's not, you know, so well known outside of serious whiskey enthusiasts. I think people would be a lot more likely to know Islay or Speyside than Campbelltown. How much have you noticed that that's changed, you know, in your 15 years? You must have noticed increased interest in Campbelltown and Glen Scotia over that time.
When I think back when I started at Glen Scotia, you know, obviously Springbank really were a draw for people. Campbelltown, the region, was Springbank. That was it. You know, that's everyone came to see Springbank, which is quite rightly so, you know, obviously a great distillery. But what I've seen over the last intervening years is, you know, there's, and I've got to say, you mentioned it yourself, a 25-year-old was probably a pivotal point. You know, we were doing well, we'd been picking up a bit of interest in Glen Scotia with new whiskies, quite interesting, you know, obviously a lot of regionality with them. So it's something different. It's maybe not a region, as you mentioned, that you go to straight away. You'd maybe in your whiskey journey, you'd start off with Speyside and make it to Islay, and then potentially if you're really into your whiskies, then you go to Campbelltown, because they're maybe not for everyone. Plus, probably you can't get them anyways. Certainly doesn't help. When you get to the 25-year-old, James, you know, you really, it's been unbelievable. And it's created, as the saying goes, be careful what you wish for, because it's created a whole raft of issues, because we just don't have enough. We don't have enough stock. You know, the demand has been phenomenal. And yeah, we're obviously fat production, but obviously trying to keep an eye on that spirit quality and looking at all the different aspects associated with that. And I've got to say, the team we've got now, phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal. So yeah, it's going well. It's incredible. And I sometimes wonder, will it ever stop? Hope not, but it's busy. It's busy.
Tell me about the whiskey experiment events that you've run in Australia, I think in Hobart and Melbourne, while you're here. And I believe that, you know, this is sort of something you did with Becky Paskin, who I've met once before, and sort of started out in Campbelltown.
Yeah, I mean, that was amazing. You know, so all credit to Becky. You know, it's really her, this was her baby, you know, the whiskey experiment. She was really, really passionate about it. It's a fantastic concept, it really is. And I was Becky's understudy, I think is the best way of describing it, at the Campbelltown Festival. If I'm honest, I was sceptical. You know, it's obviously I've been doing it the way I've been doing it for a few years now. So Becky, obviously, wonderful spirits, writer, consultant, and she really carried it off so well. It worked so well, that much that obviously here I am. Touring, it's the first time, obviously first time in Australia. And in fact, last night was the first night, so we're in Hobart with the Whiskey Club. Everyone really, really seemed to enjoy it. They really get engaged in it. And I think that's the secret with the Whiskey Experiment. It's just having an open mind, enjoying it, and not quite, you know, the usual aspect, you know, looking at your flavours, you know, what flavours you've got, which, you know, it's obviously power of suggestion, a lot of that. And yeah, it really worked well. You know, the whole concept really works well. And I think it gives people a slightly different take on it, you know, a different path to follow. I'm sold. So yeah, I'll keep touring with the Whiskey Experiment.
What are the key principles, though, of what you're trying to show?
Well, what you're really trying to do, you know, rather as me, you know, when I'm tasting you, be tasting you, you know, obviously, but absolutely, James, you know, we're getting vanilla, fudge, toffee. You're really looking at the subject of neurogastronomy, okay? So you're really, you're influenced by your surroundings, your environment, by light, colour, sound, you know, everything like that is really going to have the impact on you. And you're obviously, you're bitter, you're sweet, your sour, your salt, umami flavours. So if we're obviously sitting at the side of, you know, a lovely ocean, the waves were breaking on the rocks, you picture that, lovely blue scene, then chances are you're going to get a lot of salt. You know, it might be quite soft and salty. And that's how you'll obviously, the guys that's doing it will obviously mark that out in their diagram. You know, so we'll work through one whiskey in different contexts. You know, you could have, as I say, the ocean, then you could have lovely, soft, summery, warm colours, which will obviously maybe give you something more sweet. So it's really trying to get the brain to engage with everything else that's around you, you know, and keeping an open mind.
You realise how much humans are influenced by their surroundings and how kind of flawed we are at pure assessment of something like that. We're very easily influenced, right?
Absolutely. Because, yeah, you know, when you taste whiskey, you know, we tend to, the vanilla, the fudge, you know, we go there, you know, and that's it. And everyone says, yeah, I get
groundbreaking,
that.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's a bit repetitive. So it's nice to have someone who's obviously looked at it differently. And as I say, for me, yeah, I mean, I think it's wonderful because it allows you to engage slightly different with the audience. You know, you've got a different approach. And I think that's good for everyone that's there because it potentially it'll give them a different pathway. It'll give them a different options when they're tasting whiskey. You know, potentially you're more potentially go and relax drinking whiskey like that. You know, you're going to sit at the side of lovely beach and the colours and, you know, everything that goes with it, even the sounds, the sights, everything will, you know, it'll give you that environment just to tune in the whiskey.
Now, I believe there's a limited edition whiskey, the festival edition from that Campbelltown festival that we're going to see in Australia later this year. Tell me about that product. This will be a new release 2023 one that's
yes.
coming out here, not the 2022 one that everyone's already had. Kind
yes,
of thing. Yeah,
absolutely. So that's going to be the white port finish. So, yeah, I mean, a lot of these whiskies are, as I say, you know, for the festival, you know, they're short-lived. They tend to sell out. There's so much demand for. There's so much demand I can't even get them for the shop, but that's another story. But, yeah, I mean, you're going to get quite a lot out here, James. You know, it's obviously coming out of Australia. Sean Rankins is doing a wonderful job out here. So, yeah, he's making sure that you get your fair share of that. And it's wonderful to see because, as I say, there's never enough to go around. The last few festivals we've done, festival releases. Last year was the 8-year-old the PTPX finish. We've had the Tawny Port before that. We've had the red wine. Rum finish, and I think the original one was a Ruby Port. So they're all distinctive. The casks have all got that association with Campbelltown. They've got that regionality there. This, you know, a lot of the, especially the modern ones now, we're getting into the, obviously, a lot of the stuff that was laid down in my era, I guess, with the guys. Then they're getting slightly younger, which obvious reasons is, you know, the stock profile's diminishing. But hopefully the quality is improving. So yeah, you'll obviously, this one you'll enjoy.
Very intriguing.
Yeah.
As we just talked about, you did the whiskey experiment in Hobart last night. Did you get an opportunity to try some local drams as well while you were in town?
Yeah, I mean, as soon as I landed, I says to Sean, let's go to Lark.
Nice.
So he took me to Lark and...
Friends of the Drinks Adventures podcast, we just had Chris from Lark on a couple of weeks ago.
Brilliant. Love it. Absolutely love it. That was my first port of call, you know, said this taxi full of cases. Poor guy waited on me. You know, he was sitting there and he waited till we were down. So we got a wee tour around the distillery. Fantastic distillery, fantastic location. But the whiskey's amazing. I love the whiskey. Big fan of Lark. I really am. The team there, a lot of team came to the whiskey experiment last night. It's a wonderful team, you know, and the way they go about their business, I was mashing in, they had me mashing in. So, you know, I really enjoyed the whole experience. Really fantastic. So, a lot of people go to Scotland and they make that pilgrimage to go to wherever, Glen Scotia, Springbank, wherever they're going, Ardbeg or wherever. For me, Tasmania is a big, you know, a big place, and I'm desperate to go to Tasmania and see. You know, I wish I had more time there, but it was pretty much just a few hours. So, you know, so I'll be back though. But yeah, I've really got to thank the guys, you know, at Lark, because they were amazing. They were accommodating. And as I say, love the whiskey.
Well, Ian, you know, before I let you go, you know, what keeps you at Glen Scotia? You've obviously done 15 years there now. There's no sort of yearning to go and experience working at another distillery, or do you sort of see yourself as staying at Glen Scotia for the rest of time?
It's a very good question, James. And never say never, as I say. You know, it's very hard because you don't know the twists and turns life takes. For me, Glen Scotia, it has been a labour of love. You know, it's more than a job. If it was a job for me, I would have gave it up years ago because my wife wouldn't have put it up with it. So yeah, I really enjoyed it. You know, I still do enjoy it.
And you need to stay and see the fruits of, it's the nature of whiskey, isn't it?
That it is.
If you move on, you don't kind of get to be a part of seeing some of these projects come to light.
So. Very true. Yeah, that's very true. And it's quite a long, drawn out process. So, you know, we're getting to the point now where I'm seeing a lot of that stuff. You know, in the early days when the team was slightly smaller, there was five of us at that time. So a lot of that's coming through now, you know, the 2013 onward, you know, even 2009, which we had rum finish, the whiskey club, you know, that was obviously when it was just three of us. But now we're getting to the stage where the 2013 onwards, where there's five of us. And we'll undoubtedly in future years, we'll get to the stuff where there's how many have we got now? Seven of us. So yeah, it's amazing. It really is, you know, and it's wonderful to see. And I've got to say, I feel incredibly privileged to, you know, have the job I'm in and obviously get to visit places like Australia. So
wonderful. We're glad to have you and hope you enjoy the rest of your time here.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Lovely to chat to you, James, and thank you for your time. Thank you.
And you can find Glen Scotia single malt whisky exclusively in vintage cellars, Liquorland, and First Choice Liquor outlets across Australia.